maybe some flurries, a high of 32 with cold northwest winds up to 40 miles per hour. This morning, wind northwest at 25, gusting to 39. It is 31 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're devoting today's program to three wonderful children's books related to the season of Christmas. One newly published, the other two favorites from the past. Enjoy. And we're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about a lovely new children's book called Merry and Hark, A Christmas Story. And it is by someone who has really made a name for herself in the field of children's books. Her name is April Genevieve Tucholsky. And she has already, to her credit, a number of widely known and highly regarded books for children, including Beatrice Likes the Dark, Rebecca the White House Raccoon, The Secret Life of Hidden Places, among others. Again, this latest book is Merry and Hark, A Christmas Story, featuring beautiful illustrations by Rebecca Santo and the lovely writing of my morning show guest, April Genevieve Tucholsky. April Genevieve Tucholsky, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited about this opportunity. I just love speaking to people who create beautiful children's books, and this is certainly one of them. In the brief biography of you that's on the dust jacket, it says you grew up on a farm where you spent much of your time wandering the prairie and daydreaming. And I suspect that you've opted to make mention of that rather than, you know, where you went to college and what awards you've won. You want us to know this about you because it probably is a very important impact on the fact that you've become a writer. I'm guessing so anyway.
Truly. I can tell you where my farm was. It was in South Dakota, very close to Minnesota. And it does come through all of my writing and in Merry and Hark too, because this story is about, it's about nature, it's about an owl, it's about trees. And growing up on the plains and being so close to, so tied to nature, you know, it's really, it really formed my writing in a very distinct way, I think.
I heard in an interview you did or a Q&A of some sort about one of your previous books, you making mention of the fact that you thought that there were not enough children's books out there in the world that could speak to or tell the story of introverts, that introverts are those youngsters that sometimes get kind of left off to the side or left out of the mix. And in so many cases, children's books are kind of exciting and splashy and loud. And you obviously felt a need to create children's books with a different sort of color and mood. Is that in part because you yourself were or are or have been an introvert, or does that desire stem from something else?
No, that's me. That I'm an introvert, and you can see. So this my first book, Beatrice Likes the Dark, is about a girl who's very much an introvert. And then she has an extrovert sister, and even the girl in the illustrations looks like me with the blonde hair and the round black glasses, Beatrice. And that was very much inspired by, you know, by me and my childhood and how shy I was and, you know, and how foreign cities were to me for quite a long time and just so much, just felt so overwhelming, so much noise. So, and then in Merry and Hark too, you see it a little bit, you know, I mean, I tried to make the book more pro-nature than anti-city, but you see the little owl go into the city and how overwhelmed she is. And I felt like that for a long time too.
Interesting. Yes, let's talk for a moment about Merry and Hark. And then I hope we'll have time to just ask a couple of questions of more overarching nature in terms of how you come up with your intriguing ideas and how you put your books together. But by all means, let's talk for a moment about Mary and Hark, A Christmas Story, which tells the story of a small owl by the name of Mary, M-E-R-R-Y, Mary, a northern saw-whet owl. And at several points in the book, contrast is drawn between this type of owl and maybe larger, more flamboyant or dramatic-looking owls. Tell us more about this main character and then ultimately what happens to Mary.
So this story was inspired by a real event. In November of 2020, a little northern saw-whet owl was found nesting inside the giant Rockefeller Center Christmas tree, a Norway spruce. And she was treated at a wildlife rehabilitation center and released back into the wild. But this was the first year of the pandemic, 2020, and I think this story resonated with a lot of people as the year drew to a close, because, you know, this tiny saw-whet owl, they're only about, you know, the size of your fist. They're so tiny. If she could survive in a new world, so could we. And then I saw this article come out, and I immediately started writing this book. And I think it's really important that Mary is such a small owl, and she feels so much, you know, so much more insignificant than the big owls that I mentioned in the book, the great horned owl and the snowy owl. And but all the same, she goes on a grand adventure and succeeds, survives. And I think this is really important to have her be so small. And it was, you know, it's the real story, too.
Right. I think one of the things that is especially compelling about this character is that she loves her life in the woods, especially when she gets to nestle in what she calls my favorite tree, a Norway spruce named Hark. She was proud and strong and gentle. And so she loves that life, and yet there is part of her that would like to go on a grand adventure like those she has heard of from larger and more dramatic owls. And I just think that's really intriguing, to think about somebody who might be an introvert or might really appreciate a quiet, simple life. That doesn't mean there isn't part of them that longs for something more.
It's very The Hobbit, isn't it? You know, small creatures can do big things. It's very much a Hobbit theme. I think that's probably where what I was getting inspired from as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, your protagonist ultimately is very, very surprised in this dramatic moment when this lovely tree comes crashing down because it has been harvested and is brought into the big city to be hoisted up as a beautiful Christmas tree centerpiece, and but she has to try to make sense of this brand new world in which she finds herself. You said that you didn't want to make this anti-city, but I bet that was a really tricky line to follow in terms of making this about something more than that.
Yes, it was. You know, I went back and forth a bit with my editor. I think my illustrator, Rebecca Santo, did such a good job of walking that line as well. And I also didn't want to make this book too much about, like, shaming people for cutting down trees to make Christmas trees. You know, it's a delicate line. I don't like trees being cut down in general either, but people should be able to celebrate Christmas. So it, you know, it took some fiddling to get it right, and I hope I did.
I think you did. There's actually a beautiful spread where we see this transplanted Norway spruce looking beautiful and obviously being an inspiring sight to those around her. And Mary sees it through the window and says she is beautiful, that being the tree. They, meaning people, are trying to bring the forest to the city, I think. They are trying to bring the stars. And it's interesting to think about how that might be part of what is behind this tradition that we have. Tell us a little more about the collaboration between you and your illustrator, who is obviously very, very gifted. Again, her name is Rebecca Santo, and what she's created visually is breathtaking. How did the two of you work together on this?
So my editor asked me what kind of art I was looking for, and I sent her some examples, and then they found Rebecca. And the first I saw was sketches that came in, and I loved them, and I was so happy with them. And so then she illustrated this book. She's fantastic. She's so wonderful. She's so talented. I actually wept when I saw her illustrations, because I felt like she'd given my story more meaning. Like, I understood my own story better after seeing her artwork. It was incredible. It's picture books, though, and in children's books are so wonderful, just so magical for this, because I can see my words come to life in a way that I haven't before in all my writing. I've been writing for some time, and I really, really love doing children's books.
We're speaking with April Genevieve Tucholsky and talking about her most recent book, which is a lovely new children's book called Mary and Hark, A Christmas Story. A really beautiful, in more ways than one, children's picture book. I think a lot of people from the outside looking in assume that putting together a children's book is much, much simpler than in fact it is. Describe, first of all, kind of where your ideas come from, your initial ideas, and then typically what you have to do with those ideas in order to have them, you know, ultimately become a beautiful and effective children's book.
So, as I said, this story was inspired by a real event. My previous children's book, Beatrice Likes the Dark, was inspired by my own childhood. So I have a lot of ideas and a lot of inspirations for everything that I write. But it's a long process. I sold this book in January 2021, so it was a full 2 years of perfecting the writing, because children's books, it's like poetry. You know, you have a very few amount of words, maybe 500 to 1,000 words in a book, 1,000 being the upper limit, which my book is. And so it's very much about picking the right word and then having it all align with the illustrator. But it's a beautiful process. I loved every minute of it.
What about the matter of crafting the story in such a way that a youngster will make sense of it? I mean, particularly, I mean, when we're above, you know, See Jane Run, I mean, when we're into something that's a potentially a bit more sophisticated, maybe a story that is highly symbolic or metaphorical or whatever. I mean, what do you think about in terms of making sure that this is a story with whom the typical very young reader can and will relate?
I think about what I wanted when I was a child. That helps a lot. And I think children are sophisticated, and they understand complex emotions. And so I didn't shy away from that. But since I loved fantasy as a child, I have that in here. I talk about Mary and the owls telling stories of the hero owls. And there's a magical element in it as well that I think, I mean, I at least responded to when I was young. And you know, I think also the illustrations are so important, because I remember the illustrations of the picture books that I was read to so vividly. And, you know, this, I think, you know, having the text, the words be very, very clear, but also simple is the perfect balance, if that makes sense.
You made mention of your editor and how maybe the two of you went back and forth in a couple of aspects of this story. I don't know if you want to talk more specifically about that or leave it in more general terms, but I think it would be really interesting for us to better understand that relationship, that connection between author and editor, which I think, again, most of us have maybe a clearer notion of when it comes to, you know, a novel or a work of nonfiction versus a children's book like this.
Yes. So really the only element that was tricky was figuring out exactly how afraid to make Mary of the city. Because when you're telling children a story, you know, you have to be very careful with that. I wanted to present nature, you know, in a positive way and write the story so that it felt true. And an owl being in a city would be terrifying for that owl, but also not to make children afraid of the city. So that took a little bit of finessing, but I think we did it. It turned out good. So
when you are relatively done with a story, what do you end up presenting? In a sense, for an editor to look at. And are we talking about something that has any illustrations yet whatsoever, or does all of that element come in much later?
It largely comes in much later, though when I'm writing just the text, I will occasionally put in an illustration idea. Because sometimes if I don't want to say something in the text and waste words that way, then I can say the illustration shows it. And then it helps me figure out how to use my words in the right way, because words are so, it's such a precious commodity in a children's book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I really, really loved this book so much, and I am already excited about the youngsters to whom I'm going to give it as a gift, and I hope a lot of people will also seek it out as well. It's Mary and Hark, A Christmas Story. Written by April Genevieve Toholke, and the illustrations are by Rebecca Santo. This is published by Algonquin Young Readers. Mary and Hark, Mary, M-E-R-R-Y, as befits this festive season. And April Genevieve Toholke, thank you so much, first of all, for giving the world this really, really exquisite book. And thank you for being my morning show guest. It was really fun to speak with you about it.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives. I have a feeling that many of you know the name W. Bruce Cameron. He is the best-selling author of A Dog's Purpose, a really huge book, and he is also well-known for its best-selling sequel, A Dog's Journey. And I am so excited to be able to reconnect now with W. Bruce Cameron to talk about his book called The Dogs of Christmas. It is an absolutely lovely novel in which we meet a young man named Josh who finds his relatively simple life turned upside down with the unexpected arrival of a pregnant dog. And then that dog's pups or other puppies that suddenly find themselves in his life. And it's nothing he's prepared for, nothing he's ever experienced before. But he manages to embrace this unexpected new reality in his life with surprising success. And indeed, it is a heartwarming and inspiring story in so many, many respects. And I'm very excited to be able to speak now with W. Bruce Cameron about his latest book. W. Bruce Cameron, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to be talking with you again. I love the dedication of the book to the people all over the world who have opened their hearts and their homes to orphaned animals. I thought that would be a really good place to start. You obviously have a great love of animals yourself, and particularly dogs. But I wonder if this matter of taking in orphaned animals resonates with you on some kind of personal level due to maybe personal experience or other ways in which you've come to really appreciate what a loving gesture it is when somebody does this.
Oh, yeah. I would say that the message of The Dogs of Christmas is a question. And the question is, do we rescue animals or do they rescue us? As you put it very succinctly and well when you summed up the plot of the book. You've got a young man named Josh who is isolated and alone. He sort of lives like a mountain man up in Colorado, in Evergreen, Colorado. And then everything changes. His life gets completely upended when these dogs show up. He is unprepared for it. and unprepared for the changes it'll make in his life. But eventually, of course, they turned out to be positive, and why wouldn't they be? It's a box full of puppies at Christmas. I mean, that's going to cheer anybody up.
Right.
But the plot, the basis was inspired by the story of my own little dog, Tucker, who was a rescue dog who was dropped off still slick from birth. Brand new dog was dropped off at a shelter in a box, and they just happened to have a lactating German Shepherd who had just weaned her pups. And I think they brought the box of puppies in and said something like, "Hey, remember that wild weekend at the Sigma Chi house? Because here you go," and introduced a new box of puppies, and this dog took care of them. And that's how I got my dog, Tucker. And Tucker has indeed rescued me. I was in the doldrums because I thought I was never going to adopt a dog again. But in a similar fashion to Josh and the Dogs of Christmas, my daughter rescued Tucker. She actually runs a rescue in Denver, and she called me and said, "I'm bringing you this dog," and that let me know that you know, you lose a dog and you say, "I can't go through that again," and then you get another dog and you think, "What was I thinking? Why didn't I do this before?"
It's interesting how Josh is, in a sense, exactly the right choice for somebody who can be kind of transformed by this experience. In that, I mean, he's by all evidence a great guy, but someone who's basically never owned a dog before, and a very typical guy in the sense of having a lot of deep feelings, but not particularly good at expressing them, and some other ways in which you know, he's exactly the kind of guy whose sort of barriers are almost inevitably going to come down. What else did you think about in creating this central character of Josh and making him interesting and someone familiar to us and yet not just kind of a cookie cutter caricature?
Yeah, when I wrote The Dogs of Christmas, what I was intrigued by is how we in today's society seem to be both more social and less social. We're spending more time on social media. We're texting people, we're emailing people, but we're spending less and less time with people. It's easy now to spend your entire day sitting in front of the computer and feel as if you've had a lot of great social interactions. And I suppose by some definitions you have, but you're not interacting with anything but your fingertips, perhaps. You know, you're just not, and you're very coldly exchanging these text messages. I wanted to write a story about someone who is going into that world sort of not involuntarily, but willingly, and in doing so, was losing his heart a little bit. And then along come the Dogs of Christmas and pull him back out. You know, you can't text with your dog. You have to take your dog for a walk. You have to interact with your dog. I wanted to write about how you can find the human side of yourself if you just know where to look. And if where to look is nosing you because he wants to go out in the yard for a walk, I think that's a pretty helpful thing in the world.
We're speaking with W. Bruce Cameron about his newest book called The Dogs of Christmas. Another very, very important character in this book is Carrie, who works at the local animal shelter. And one of the things that's so striking, I hate to give too much away, but you should say that the very first encounter between Josh and Carrie, which is over the phone, is not a very positive one. And and actually, in some ways, we're not given all that positive a first impression of who Carrie is and what she's like. Tell us about her and about this first encounter which Josh has with Carrie over the phone.
Yeah, Josh, you know, Josh has these puppies and feels like the thing you do when you have puppies is you call the animal rescue people and they come get them. As far as he's concerned, that's the method. He doesn't know any different. Carrie, when she answers the phone, is very cold toward him because what Josh doesn't know is that in animal rescue, they don't have the resources to sit and bottle feed puppies. And in this case, what would be happening, and again, not to give too much away, but Josh believes that the proper course is to give over the puppies themselves and not Lucy, the lactating shepherd that he has. So that's complicated. I don't want to get into that. But Carrie's response is really cold, because to her, what Josh is saying is, I'm gonna drop off these puppies for you to euthanize, because that's what would have to happen. They can't do it any other way. And a lot of people don't know that about dropping puppies off at a, they have to be weaned or their chances of survival are nil at a shelter. Yeah, and Carrie, I know a lot of people in animal rescue, and Carrie is sort of a compilation of those people. They're very strong-willed. They have seen enough startlingly inhuman behavior on the part of people abandoning or abusing animals, and they have to have a strong spine to put up with that. And that is Carrie. She comes off very abrasive at first.
Absolutely.
Because she's very protective of the dogs.
Absolutely. And so exasperated with people, and especially someone as clueless as Josh, who is completely clueless when it comes to this new situation in which he finds himself. And yet then the first time we meet Carrie in person, which is when she actually makes her way to his rather remote home to see these puppies for herself, and with the puppies she is as warm and cuddly and loving and tender-hearted as anyone could possibly be. And I thought that was really intriguing. It's probably something that we've seen before in a sense, but I think you do an especially good job of painting that picture very persuasively of someone who can interact with a box of puppies very differently than she interacts with a whole lot of human beings in her life.
Oh, yeah. I mean... And from the moment he sees her, Josh he's pretty interested in Carrie, and he immediately sets out to try to court her very awkwardly, and does a really poor job. It feels very real to my own life, where, you know, in the courtship phase of my life, I've always given myself pretty much Fs. I've never been very good at it. And Josh is sort of like that. He's just not very good at trying to entice this woman. You know, she's over there to see the dogs of Christmas, but he wants her to be around to see him. Hmm. And I think one of the most fun things I've written is this slow dance between Carrie and Josh, where we're just not sure if Carrie's interested in Josh. He seems to blow it every time he talks to her, and yet she keeps coming back. What does that mean? That's the kind of stuff that feels very real to me in romance.
Absolutely. Another whole layer to this book has to do with Josh and his own family. And with many of his family members, he has either complicated or distant relationships. And this is also something that I think you do a really good job of painting very realistic portraits here of these relationships fraught with various complexities or difficulties of one kind or another. Tell us a little bit about where that comes from, or maybe just try to describe the care with which you tried to describe these relationships and make them feel so authentic.
Yeah, when I was writing the Dogs of Christmas, what I wanted to portray was a man, and this Josh, who is has built up a defensive wall against the world without really realizing it. He thinks he is embracing the important things of life and keeping them alive, but what he's really doing is refusing to move on. He just can't seem to cope with the fact that his family doesn't live in the house where he lives. This is his childhood home that he has arranged to wind up with, and he actually bought it back on the market. So he lives in his family's home. That's kind of an odd thing for someone to do. But to Josh, it makes sense, and he wishes he had all the old Christmas decorations that his mom had, because in a way, that's his defense against the changing world, and that is his... that's where his hurt kind of comes out. He's got a lot of hurt in him because of some things that happened in his family. And that's something that Carrie can help him with, because she, in her no-nonsense ways, can sniff out these problems that he's got and expose them to the light and let him see that he needs to move on. And he manages to decide that Carrie is worth it, that he's willing to abandon some of these long-held principles and preconditions of existence that he's been wrestling with, because he is so enticed by this Carrie woman.
Hmm. Your book also takes us into the really sensitive arena of what it means to take someone in when there is this very real possibility that someone will come along and take them right back out of your life again. Particularly when it comes to something like opening your home to what might be a lost animal or a stolen animal or whatever. And I think a lot of us, if we've never walked this particular road, don't stop to think about what that would feel like. And in particular, the real danger that is there, that you are opening yourself up to an enormous load of hurt if suddenly all of this, in a sense, gets reversed in a way that is beyond your control.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that Josh learns in The Dogs of Christmas is a lesson that dogs teach us, and that is that regardless of the circumstances, they are temporary visitors in our lives. When we adopt dogs and we bring dogs into our house, we know it's a temporary arrangement. We know that they have short lifespans. We do it anyway because of the joy they bring us. And then I really think one of the most important things they do for us is they teach us that even though life is short, it can be lived joyfully. And a lot of times I will catch myself so preoccupied with some project and so focused that I've sort of lost track of the point of life, which is to be joyful and to love life. And when I realize I'm doing that, I try to go back and live life like the dogs. I try to say that every day is worth living and that I should find something to be happy about every day, because, look, that's what dogs do. I mean, they're no matter what's going on, they're happy to be doing it. They want to get in the car, they want to get out of the car, you know. they think everything's great. Hmm. Why can't we live like that? And when they're leaving us, they're leaving us with a legacy of joy and optimism that I think we should embrace.
Hmm.
And hopefully in The Dogs of Christmas, you know, you've got puppies at Christmas. It's a great gift book. It's a great little story that's I hope makes people happy and makes them forget about problems for a little while and just concentrate on a sweet story at Christmas time. That's the aim.
Right. And, of course, one of the central themes of this book is one which has run through several of your previous books as well. At one point when Carrie and Josh are having what in many respects is kind of a difficult conversation about what you and I were just talking about, she is trying to explain to Josh, because being with us is a dog's purpose, Josh. We bred the species to be that way. The ones that didn't want to live with people weren't allowed to reproduce. So after thousands of years, it's literally in their blood. That is, dogs are meant to be with us. It's what makes them happy. And in a sense, when we allow it to make us happy too, you have a very, very special relationship there indeed.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you called out that segment of the book, because to me that is one of the most moving scenes in the book, because that's how I feel about dogs. I mean, a dog's purpose, a dog's journey. I wouldn't have written so many books with a dog on the cover if it weren't for the fact that I just feel that they're here with a very special purpose.
I want to make a quick mention of the fact too that along the way we learn a lot about dogs. And for instance, there's a pregnant dog in this book who gives birth to pups, and there's all kinds of interesting information that we learn along the way. And as I recall, I think in your acknowledgments, there's somebody in your life who is really responsible for helping you have all of this kind of fun knowledge about body temperature and what to feed a pregnant dog and the new puppies and how to feed them. And I mean, a lot of that interesting information is like a wonderful little bonus along the way.
Yeah, I have a couple of veterinarian friends that I abuse on a regular basis by picking up the phone and calling and asking, okay, what's the story here? You know, what would happen if this happened? I continually ask them. They must get tired of getting those phone calls. But, you know, I'm an author. My job in writing The Dogs of Christmas was to tell a good story and to try to adhere to, you know, the facts about dogs. But I'm not a veterinarian. I didn't go to vet school. So when it comes time to trying to come up with this stuff, I have to turn to the experts. I would hate it if somebody read one of my books and, well, it happens all the time. I'll get some fact wrong, generally because I thought I knew what I was talking about. So I have to be very disciplined in recognizing that I seldom know what I'm talking about. And my job is to write down what the smart people say. That's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great book on all kinds of different levels, and not just for what we sort of learn along the way, but for also the way in which we grow very, very attached to both the human beings and the dogs that are in this lovely book, The Dogs of Christmas, published by Forge. And W. Bruce Cameron, congratulations on yet another lovely book. I am so glad we had the chance to speak about it today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we're turning to the Morning Show archives for a conversation from 2007 with Charles M. Cohen, perhaps the leading authority on the work of Theodore Geisel, whom the world knows as Dr. Seuss. The occasion of this conversation was the release of a 50th anniversary edition of Dr. Seuss's classic children's book, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I wonder if you would explain to our listeners one of the first things we see in that retrospective at the back of the book on pages 54 and 55. We see at the bottom of the page a strip of 8 different covers of this classic, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about and what that says about this story.
Thank you very much again. Yes, what I found was, as I was doing research about this, was the surprising number of languages that this book has been translated into. It was translated into Icelandic, into Hungarian, Japanese, and down at the bottom of the area you're talking about are several of these different editions. And it's interesting, too, of course, he's not called the Grinch. I think in Japanese he's Gorinichi, and in Iceland it's it's Trolli, and in Hungary it's Gorcs. So he's become a well-known figure, not just where we know about him here, but all over the world.
As we learned from your previous book, so many of the creations that we've come to know and love by Dr. Seuss often had kind of long gestation periods in which he would maybe get the kernel of an idea and it would come to life in various forms and in kind of different stages before finally emerging. Tell us just how circuitous a route it was in this case from original idea to final flowering.
You put that so perfectly. I could have used you writing the book. That was wonderful. he had a phenomenal memory, Ted Geisel, and things would stick there. He would get an image or a thought, and he might work it out in one of his cartoons. He used to be a cartoonist and an advertising man. And then, I think completely unaware, they would just sit there for maybe 2 decades and then blossom later. In this case, the first inkling I really saw of a Grinch character was back in the late 20s. He was combining several different things that children told their parents about. The parents told their children about. Things like the Sandman or the Boogeyman and the Santa Claus and the stork bringing children. And he said it was too much for kids to really remember and that we should roll them all into one. And so he drew this image of a stork with antlers, and he's delivering a Santa Claus, which is also a combination of the Boogeyman, you know, to someone's roof. And I think that Santa Claus Boogeyman image was probably the first idea of what a Grinch would be like. And then, and you're talking almost exactly 30 years later, when the book finally comes out. Now, in between, he continued to play with various ideas about the images that we have of Christmas, what would bring Santa, you know, how would you change a reindeer, what else would you use. In the book, we used a couple of the Christmas cards that he made for family back in the 30s, and in one of them, there's a series of five of the typical Susian beasts delivering Santa, and him saying, after all, reindeer are so common. You know, he would play with these various images, and so I tried in the book to show that development, how the Grinch went from this boogeyman Santa into an advertisement for Holly Sugar, which is the first time you see a Grinch looking like the Grinch we know, taking Max and having him evolve from a dachshund with deer with antlers into the animal that we know with the antlers being tied on. And the same thing for the Who's, for example. Mm.
It's really interesting, too, to look at some of those early examples of a character called the Grinch. I mean, to see Dr. Seuss use the term Grinch not to describe the specific character that we know from this story. I mean, sometimes it'll be a relatively pleasant-looking character that will be called a Grinch for whatever reason. That it takes us a moment to get over the shock of that.
Well, this is the fun of this part of my job. I get to find out of all these things. The first time that he used the word Grinch, it actually referred to a bird. There's a bald-headed Grinch that sits on a rock, and it's in the book Scrambled Egg Super from, I think it's 1953. The main character walks by, and that bird isn't laying eggs that day. So it was a completely different thing. And then he shows up a couple of years later in a story called The Hubbub and the Grinch, and this is another pleasure in doing a retrospective like this is that people have probably never heard of The Hubbub and the Grinch, and we get to show people that story. But at that time, a Grinch was developing this sort of nasty streak. Basically, it was someone who sells people things that they don't need. In this case, a piece of green string that he convinces someone to buy, or rather a hubbub to buy. And then at the same year that he's having a Grinch sell people things they don't need, that's when he draws this Grinch character that we think of, and he's selling people sugar. So he tended to do this where he didn't think so much about the interplay between the two, the commentary.
Mm. Of course, for a lot of people, they know this story best either from the most recent live-action feature film, or maybe even more likely from the magnificently rendered animated special from the mid-1960s. I suppose in either case, if that's how you primarily know this story, it's going to be a real revelation, in a sense, to pick up this book and read the story in its original form, although it really shows us how true the animated special was to this original work.
It's part of I find fascinating the evolution. You know, when I went into this, I had forgotten that the Grinch had shown up pretty much every decade as a reimagined, slightly different-looking character. When you ask someone what color is the Grinch, they automatically say green. We all think of him as green. But when you look at the book, you realize that he was originally black and white with pink eyes and occasionally that red Santa suit. So the 1966 special that you're referring to that he did with Chuck Jones, in some ways almost supplanted this in the general consciousness that people have. But when you go back, this is still very endearing. There's something charming about this original. It was interesting. He was able to do such a fantastic job with Chuck Jones because they had worked together already in the Army on films. So they had a rapport. That one, Ted's main contribution was all of these lyrics for these wonderful songs sung by Thurl Ravenscroft. But people may not be aware, just like they wouldn't know about the Hubbub and the Grinch, but the Grinch in 1977 appeared in a story for television called Halloween is Grinch Night, which won an Emmy. And then in 1982, there was a story called The Grinch Grinches the Cat in the Hat, which also won two Emmys. And Ted wrote both of the scripts for those. And then, of course, people know him from the 2000 movie with Jim Carrey. So this is part of what adds to his popularity. The original book people can read now. His messages are still timely, still relevant, but also people have seen it. You know, new generations have seen it in ways that are comfortable for them.
Hmm. I think in your retrospective, you really point out kind of an interesting point, which is that, you know, here you are really doing a lot of research about Dr. Seuss, and in this case, really carefully tracing the emergence of this work and the way in which it's been transformed over the years. You point out quite rightly that there are people that have done PhD theses on How the Grinch Stole Christmas and other Dr. Seuss works. And you share with us something that Ted Geisel said at one point upon when confronted with that that reality, that people were putting his works under such a careful sort of microscope.
Yeah, it's an odd position to be in. I always keep in mind that the quotation you're talking about where people asked him about that, and he would say how people would do this thesis about his particular use of a color, you know, a single color. And, you know, I've read these things, whether they be in theses or just in critiques, and people will go on and on about a particular color, and then he'll point out that it had nothing to do with that. It was that Random House was having a little tough time financially at the time and told him to cut down his number of colors. So I'm always aware of drawing conclusions. And it was a very risky thing to do, even if you listened to interviews that he did or read interviews, because he was such a great storyteller. All he cared about was amusing people, that he didn't always tell the truth. So, you know, you have to, this is my job, is to go back to the first-hand sources, sort through the stories he told or the things that we've come to think about him, and get back to what really had happened.
Hmm. It's interesting, too, you quote his memoirs where Ted Geisel said, "It's the product that's the most important, not the process of how it was created." It's so ironic that he said that, because, in fact, your magnificent first book, The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, is almost entirely taken up with that process. And we're so glad you disregarded Ted Geisel's thoughts on that, because, I mean, really, it only enhances our appreciation of the final product when we understand the process by which it was created.
Well, I appreciate that analysis and your incredible memory about the previous book. It's true. I think that both are true. I think what he was trying to get at was that in the end, as the artist, what he wants to see is the final product. He wants to see that this is something people can enjoy, that the artwork came out well. I mean, this was agonizing for him. We look at a book and we say, you know, it's only got 200 lines in it. You know, how long can that have taken to write this children's book? But he would agonize for a year and painstakingly to try to get down that rhythm we think of as Dr. Seuss, you know, that particular lilt to the language was just such an effort for him. And, you know, that when that's all done, you want to know that that's what you want people to focus on. He didn't care about the process. But, you know, when afterwards, I mean, that's fine when the book first comes out, but, you know, you and I, I'm sure, and many of your listeners have enjoyed these books. Well, here we are 50 years. It's also interesting for those of us who want to go beyond that to find out, where do these things come from? You know, for him, it's hard in an interview. He had a thing he would tell people, if there's this place called Zabilnikov, you know, near the Swiss Alps, and he would go there every year to get his cuckoo clock fixed, and this is where he got his ideas for his books. I mean, he would just make things like that up because he didn't want to have to answer the questions. That was tedious. What he wanted to do was talk about the work. But for us now, it's fascinating, and I don't think he knew. I don't think he realized that the images that we see had occurred to him earlier. That wasn't of interest to him, but I think now if he could read them and go, geez, you know what, I completely forgot about that. And at the risk of running on in this, I had just spoken with his agent, Herb Cheyette, who delivered Ted Geisel's memorial, a wonderful story. I don't know if we have time for the whole story, but basically the point of the story was about Ted deciding that rather than being paid the most money per word, he would rather turn down the most money per word. And this story was about a piece that we included in this book. It was called A Prayer for a Child. But at the time, they didn't even know that that had been published. This is his own agent, and Ted didn't remember writing that piece. It was a complete surprise to him when he saw that. The person who told the anecdote in 1991 at the memorial told me he didn't know that that was the piece until he read the previous book you were talking about in 2004. So, you know, Ted just, he did these things. He did such a massive amount of work that a lot of it would have been unfamiliar to him, and that's why it's worth doing these things and showing the process, as you had said.
Well, we're glad you did it, and we're so glad to have this 50th anniversary edition of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And Charles D. Cohen, a great pleasure to speak with you again. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure talking to you.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, something a little bit out of the ordinary, we'll be talking to Sal Contanese and his two sons, who own and operate one of the largest home inspection firms in Chicagoland. And we'll talk about the whole business of inspecting homes and what a prospective home buyer should be thinking about if they are engaging in this process. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast today is for mostly sunny skies but chilly conditions and perhaps a few snow flurries. Our high today, 32 degrees. Wind chills at times will be in the single digits. Overnight, a low of 17. Tomorrow's high, 43. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public.